Today we're talking about Brazil, Terry Gilliam's dystopian comedy from 1985. We'll also delve into Josh's sordid past in public school music education, have a totally unpretentious discussion of Franz Kafka, and I'll talk about Michael Stipe more than I should, but not nearly as much as I want to. That's all coming up on Uncharted Space. Hello and welcome to Uncharted Space. I'm Craig.
I'm Josh.
And each week we take a science fiction property that one of us has seen, knows, and loves, and the other has not.
And what are we doing this week, Craig?
Ooh, I think this week we're talking about the Terry Gilliam 1985 masterpiece, Brazil.
Very good. Now, this is a movie that I've not seen. And furthermore, I have to admit that the only non-Python Gilliam film that I have seen, as far as I know, is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And I'm looking at the list and it's shocking and disappointing. I'm disappointed in myself that I haven't seen most of these movies.
I didn't realize that Fear and Loathing was Terry Gilliam, so that makes me feel like a bad person.
Well, I feel like that puts us on even footing then.
I did buy, I forget what he called it, the Don Quixote movie that he made.
Oh.
It was supposed to be with Johnny Depp, but then he remade it with Adam Driver, and there was a documentary that came first called Lost in La Mancha. Oh, it's The Man Who Killed Don Quixote. That's what it is.
That's right. And this came out in 2018.
Yeah. And I bought that and I still haven't seen it. Maybe after tonight, getting all hot and heavy with Brazil.
Now, my understanding is that this movie is not, in fact, about the nation of Brazil.
No.
Nor is it set anywhere on the continent of South America.
Brazil is an aspiration.
Okay, so the title is not like a complete non sequitur.
I think it is a complete non sequitur and not at the same time. I have to ask you, Josh, you were and I apologize if I'm using an offensive term, you were a band kid.
I sure was.
Okay. Is there another word you prefer that doesn't have the, you know, the connotations?
A bandman.
Oh, a bandman. I like that. Well, Josh, you were a bandman and I was a theater kid.
A theaterman.
There were no practical skills, though, that a bandman has, so I don't feel like you can be a theaterman. But I feel like all the theatermans, theater kids, watched Brazil. Was that not the case with the bandmans? Did the bandmans not watch Brazil?
I think the band persons.
Oh, that's good.
Didn't watch anything except for, like, jazz educational videos.
Okay.
I don't remember us coalescing around any particular piece of cinema other than maybe like the Dave Weckl fusion special.
Now, I know you just said jazz educational cinemas, but because I'm not a bandman, my mind immediately went to jazzercise and I pictured 50 kids with like their trumpets and drums sitting watching like Jane Fonda and that, but that's not what it was.
Richard Simmons.
Or Richard Simmons. Yeah. Okay.
No, it's probably not worth explaining, but
oh, no.
There is a whole genre of not film, instructional video, mostly produced by this one company called Hudson Music, wherein a famous jazzman or jazz lady will show how they do their things on their instrument.
Now, if it's jazzman, wouldn't it be jazz ludi? would you supplant that as well? But extracurricularly, I think that the reason you didn't watch Brazil is all your extracurricular television was Blues Brothers. I think we watched that 3 times when I was with you and your other bandmen back in the day.
Well, we did have a band that was less than loosely based on the Blues Brothers. Essentially a Blues Brothers cover band, in fact.
Oh.
The Money Shots.
Well, I remember the Money Shots, but I thought you had your own original musics.
I'd say it was like 10% originals, 90% straight out of the Blues Brothers movie.
Well, okay. Let's get back to Brazil. But not Brazil, sure. The country. Brazil, the film. Brazil, the film. You know nothing about this film.
I know next to nothing about this film.
It is basically 1984, if it was written by Douglas Adams of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Interesting.
Mr. Buttle Archibald has been invited to assist the Ministry of Information with certain inquiries. Sign here, please.
Daddy! Daddy! Where are you taking him?
that is your receipt for your husband. Thank you. And this is my receipt for your receipt.
It's British bureaucratic nightmare. The movie begins with this guy being kidnapped out of his home, Archibald Tuttle, and he's accidentally murdered in the course of his interrogation. It turns out that was Archibald Buttle. They were really looking for the wrong guy. Anyway, our hero is Jonathan Pryce. He's a bureaucrat who comes to find out that they got the wrong guy. The right guy they were looking for is played by Robert De Niro.
Oh, wow.
What are you doing?
Harry Tuttle, heating engineer at your service.
Are you from Central Services? I called Central Services.
But they're a little overworked these days. Luckily, I intercepted your call.
And he's at odds with Bob Hoskins, who's the air conditioning guy from Central.
Central Services.
Central Services.
Oh, yes.
You rang, sir.
You rang, sir.
Trouble with your air conditioning.
Air conditioning, sir.
No, it's
It's fixed.
Fixed.
Fixed itself.
Oh, it fixed itself.
Fixed itself.
Yes. Machines don't fix themselves.
Well, they don't fix themselves, sir.
It's very absurd. It's very Python-esque, but also, as a good dystopia is, it leaves you in a very unsettled way.
Now, does De Niro play an American character?
He blessedly, yes.
I can't really imagine De Niro playing anything else.
Maybe the character is British, but he's born without an accent, if that's the case.
Rare genetic mutation.
Yeah.
Now, you mentioned this film being Python-esque, which is not surprising given it was written and directed by Terry Gilliam. A lot of the short-form Monty Python stuff had very much to do with sending up stuffy British bureaucracy, you know, this almost like Kafka-esque type of authentically British way of being.
Yes, yes.
And less so in the Monty Python films, but I think they still sort of touch on that.
That's a good point. The films do kind of veer away from sort of the classic Britishisms as much as the short form does. But yes, Kafkaesque is a word that has been used to describe this film by people who understand what that means, which is not me. Josh explained to me Kafkaesque. It's a word I use, but I'm going to admit now, I don't really know why I use it.
I believe that Kafka was known for writing about absurdly complex bureaucratic nightmare scenarios.
Okay.
Although okay. I must admit, I don't know much more about it than that either. But thanks for calling me out here on the pod, Craig.
Well, you know, I just read the New York Times did a feature on my beloved Michael Stipe, the frontman of REM. In the article, the guy says, you know, Michael says he doesn't read much, but there's one book he kept talking about, which was, I forget the title, but basically it was like In Defense of Pretentiousness. And so I went and read the book, the guy says, and the next time I saw Michael, I said, Michael, I read that book you were talking about In Defense of Pretentiousness. And Michael said, I didn't actually finish that book, which on the one hand was perhaps the most pretentious thing imaginable, and yet also completely unpretentious that he would humbly admit that.
Or he could do what I do and just pretend like he knows what he's talking about until somebody calls him out.
Well, so yeah, definitely Kafka-esque, the film, and definitely absurd and about the sort of proliferation of bureaucracy. People were very afraid of bureaucracy in the 80s. I don't know that it's something that we need to be as afeard of today with automation and the internet.
Yeah, I mean, I think there was this really sort of mysterious rise of technology that was happening in a way that was really unfamiliar to a lot more people.
Yeah. But, you know, the last time I went to the DMV to renew my license, I was in and out in 20 minutes. That is not the world that Terry Gilliam foresaw in 1985.
Ironically, the technology is much more terrifying now, but people have just accepted it.
It's true. And we can't see it.
So, I mean, this movie came out, you said, 1985.
It's almost 40 years old.
So you and I are around the same age, which I know because we've known each other since sixth grade. But that said, you would not have been able to watch this movie when it came out in the theater.
No.
So when did you first see it?
I first saw it with a theaterman in high school. Probably I was age 15 or 16.
That was your first viewing of it.
That was my first viewing of it.
That's not surprising to me because I remember you guys being super into Monty Python in a way that I wasn't, but appreciated nonetheless.
I was on the end of the bell curve there. I think most of those theater kids in high school had been into Monty Python since they were in middle school. And I was a Johnny come lately. So it was, I enjoyed it. It was part of the thing, but I certainly wasn't as ardent a
python head? Do they have python's head like Jimmy Buffett has parrot heads?
I don't know, but I like that you used python's head, like attorneys general or...
Oh, yes, yes. Python's head, yeah.
So how did you feel about this movie when you first saw it in high school?
Similarly to 1984, what all of these kinds of stories are about is feeling trapped by society, by whatever. And that's kind of how you feel in high school. You know, you've spent your entire life up until that time feeling constricted by the path that's laid out for you by school, by your parents, by church, by whatever. And here you see sort of an exaggeration of someone being just completely stifled and, you know, the walls closing in from every direction. But I don't remember being haunted and terrified by it in the way I was with 1984.
Did the effect that this film had of sort of shining a light on the intensity of the authoritarian nature of your life drive you to want to consume any other types of media? I mean, I remember kids being into like Rebel Without a Cause and shit when we were in high school. And I'm wondering if there was like a correlation between the revelatory nature of a film like Brazil and the drive to be some sort of counterculture hero or...
That sounds both extremely cool and extremely pretentious to be into Rebel Without a Cause in the late 90s.
I mean, there's not much more pretentious than a 16-year-old.
That's true. And not... certainly the 16-year-old is the creature who feels the most trapped. Absolutely no clue for the actual box that life is going to put for you and the actual just grinding misery that lies ahead. But, you know, just having to sit somewhere for 40 minutes feels so oppressive to that age set.
The one other person besides you that I keep in touch with from youth, whose name I will not mention, but who will know who he is if he's listening to this podcast, walked around with a copy of Howl in his back pocket for...
Oh, yes.
10 years, maybe, around the time that people were getting into that kind of anti-authoritarian shit.
Yes. But unlike Michael Stipe, he read it and read Moby Dick like 4 times.
Yeah.
So, and I've read it 0 times.
I guess what I'm probing for is if this was like an inciting incident for anything else.
Ooh, that's a good question. At the time, I was doing the play Arcadia.
I remember you doing Arcadia.
Well, thank you.
Let me rephrase that. I remember that you did Arcadia.
That's, yeah. But anyway, that play is about 2 time periods taking place simultaneously on stage where sort of people in the present are digging into the past. And I would say that sitting with that was probably the deepest contemplation I had with death since I was 10 years old watching the movie Free Jack. But it was different because it was, you know, night after night sort of thinking about that. And Brazil had all of that same existential angst, but in a slightly brush your hands off and go, well, life's absurd. What are you going to do? How's the life of Brian end?
Always look on the right side of life. For life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow.
I always confuse that one with, isn't it awfully nice to have a penis?
I mean, the similar themes of the song, certainly.
It's swell to have a stiffy, it's divine to own a dick. From the tiniest little tadger to the world's biggest prick.
Real bangers, both of them.
Real bangers.
So I wanted to ask about the visual elements of this film, which I have not seen even a single clip of, but I know that Gilliam is associated with the animation in Monty Python, which had this sort of absurdist and like very in your face, almost psychedelic feel.
Yes.
He was also the director of the movie Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is like a notoriously psychedelic film. Does any of that psychedelia cross over into the film Brazil?
I think so, but through the lens of this Kafkaesque dystopian world, there's all these really cool shots of interior buildings that just have these huge, oppressive ceilings. And then you have lots of imagery of things behind the walls. That's kind of like a recurring theme. In the opening, it's the hole is drilled through a roof and it comes down, and in a later scene, Robert De Niro is opening up a panel, and there's just all sorts of chaos coming out. So it's, I would say the visual style is sort of about order holding back chaos and envisioned in a grand way that, yes, has the psychedelic elements, but channeled through this Orwellian vision.
Almost like a mirror universe Wes Anderson.
Yeah, almost like a mirror universe Wes Anderson. I don't know what that means.
I don't know either. I'm thinking about pleasing framing versus disconcerting framing. And
ooh,
I'm your description of uncomfortably tall, disproportionate, asymmetrical framing, as opposed to the like extremely carefully composed symmetry of a Wes Anderson film.
Yes, okay. It took me a moment to catch up to the Star Trek, the original series reference.
Oh, because the mirror universe. Oh, no shit, yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't cop to that one on a sci-fi podcast.
Listen, I never finished the book, The In Defense of Pretentiousness, so I've got no pretensions to uphold.
Have you ever even watched Star Trek, man?
No, I've seen a lot of Star Trek. I've seen so much Star Trek. You don't even know.
You don't even know, man.
Do you want to talk more about Michael Stipe?
That could be its own podcast for you.
It certainly could.
It could be just be Craig by himself talking about Michael Stipe.
It's true.
Into a microphone.
Yeah.
Well, you've definitely sold this movie to me as one that I want to watch. And in fact, I've been going through the Terry Gilliam filmography list here. And another one that I've realized that I've never seen that he directed is the film 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
Well, if we want to get straight into our babbling about Star Trek.
It's not babbling, Josh.
No, that's okay. We tend to discuss some
Star Trek.
Random Star Trek thing at the end of each show.
It's pillow
as
talk.
The music fades up for comedic that's effect.
Right. You're fading music up over this?
Oh, you didn't know?
Oh, boy.
Anyway, the film 12 Monkeys
was
directed by Terry Gilliam. The subsequent television program 12 Monkeys was created by a man named Terry Metalis, who would go on to become the showrunner in the third season of Star Trek Picard.
Really?
And he's the guy that's responsible for that show finally getting good.
Not just getting good, but being good.
After being nearly unwatchable.
Yeah.
Nay, entirely unwatchable for most of two seasons.
Now, if I were to say to you, Josh, what is the moment watching The Next Generation on television live back in the day that just had the most gut punch?
Oh, without question, Mr. Worf.
Fire?
Fire.
Yes. Oh, my God. That's exactly what I was thinking.
Mr. Worf. Fire.
Roll credits. And then you had to wait the whole fucking summer.
The whole summer. Yeah.
The payoff just isn't the same with Prestige TV.
I will say, though, season 3 of Picard, it felt like Mr. Worf fire for 10 straight episodes. It got me. It got my feels.
They definitely wrote it at people like us.
They did. They did a good job. And the Borg, you know, is kind of like Brazil. So, themes.
they assimilate you with their samba music?
Again, I can't stress this enough. The film is not set in Brazil nor about Brazil. It is entirely about